Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
We begin by acknowledging the Gabigabi people, the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast episode is being recorded today, and pay respects to their elders, past and present, and to their parents with children with disabilities.
This podcast contains truth, laughter, and the occasional F-word, so it's not really suitable for children.
Well, you probably won't hear quite so much swearing among the beans, you know. Well, yeah. Not suitable for children.
Sometimes you just have to get your shits out. Shit, 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 shit. That's right, this is a language warning. Oh, shit.
Hello, peas and beans. Gary Bean here. How are you? Doing all right? That's good. Glad to hear it. No, not so good. Sorry about that. I understand. We do get it here. Well, you know, whether you're doing well at the moment or not so well, thanks for putting us in your ears. I know that for the next hour or so, you're going to get to listen to something really good. Now, Marnie Davis Wood is a P who is well known to this tribe. Back in April of 2021, Marnie spoke with Kate and Mandy, and we got to hear something of her daughter Ivy's story then. It's an excellent episode, I have to tell you, so I encourage you to go back and listen to it if you haven't already. Now today you're going to hear from Daniel, who is Marnie's husband, Ivy's dad. And I have to say that this does create a lovely set of bookends, doesn't it? Marnie's story and Daniel's story, with Ivy in the centre. And what a treat it is to get both mum's and dad's perspectives. So a shout out once again to the Queen Peas for pegging out this section of the veggie garden to allow for beans to have a place to be nurtured and cherished, as well as peas. Dads, if you're listening, firstly, thanks for listening. And good on you for being there in the life of your pea shoot or bean sprout. But secondly, we want to listen to you as well. Goodness knows it's hard enough to find someone to listen to about things that don't even really matter that much. But for the things that do matter the most to us, things like our families, our children, our partners, sometimes, you know, it's hard to find someone who cares enough to actually listen. And not just for your own sake, but for the sake of the others who listen to these conversations. You don't have to be invisible, or I guess more accurately, unheard. Get in touch through the Hangout or via a speak pipe or email on the 2P's website, and we just might be able to get in touch and talk. Anyhow, I just felt like I was with a kindred spirit, you know, when I was talking with Daniel, so it was kind of therapeutic for me, in a way. Now, whether you find it therapeutic or not, I'm sure you are going to enjoy it. So, let's meet Daniel and his stellar daughter, Ivy. G'day, Daniel.
Hi, Gary.
Thanks for this, mate. It's great to talk to you. I think you're back from Scotland into Australia for a couple of months, so this is a great opportunity to catch up with you.
Yes.
We'll catch up with why you live in Scotland in a moment too, because that's a significant part of this whole story. But let's get started with Kate and Mandy's three icebreaker questions, if you will. So firstly, is there a piece of music that you would recommend, something that picks you up or is special to you for some reason?
Well, as a rule, I think silence is golden. But when I do turn to music, yeah, I actually, it's good that you mentioned Scotland because I really love Scottish traditional music, not bagpipes, that's not what I'm talking about. I mean violin instrumentals from traditional tunes. And there's one guy, Duncan Chisholm, who I think is one of Scotland's greatest fiddlers, and he has this song, it's just called Unknown Air. An air is just a type of song, so it's basically untitled. And it is, it starts off a bit melancholy and then it kind of gets a bit hopeful and then it kind of ends in this really neutral place, which is very strange and beautiful. So it's a great, you know, those days when you just feel like your head is like a jungle inside and you need someone to hack away the vines and just clear a path for you. It's that kind of song. Yeah. It does that work for me.
I'm going to check this out. So would you describe it as Celtic?
Vaguely, probably a long time back. And air is really, it's meant to be like a violin that's used like a voice. It's from the same word as aria. So you could almost hear someone singing it without any instruments. It's that kind of tune.
Thank you. Well, I'm definitely going to check that out. Second question, did you win any awards at school?
Yeah, I can't really remember. I know I was in the running for a while for the school ducks for a few years, but I don't think I ever won that. So I think I'd be inclined to say no, I didn't actually win anything. I was sort of perpetually a second place person and a bit of a rat bag as a student, to be honest. I probably didn't deserve very much. No, I don't think so. Came close, but no.
Well, like many who may be described as ratbags while they were at school, you've done very well from what you've told
also,
me.
Well, I also went on to become an educator for my sins, so it's a bit of karma in it as well.
It comes back on you. Okay, thanks for that. Well, that's good. And so then thirdly, to launch into our conversation, why would you be described as a bean?
Well, I am the father to a daughter named Ivy. She's just turned 8 last week. My wife, Marnie, has been in conversation with Kate and Mandy before and spoken a bit about her. And Ivy has kind of a range of things that we deal with. But the one that people notice straight away is that she is profoundly deaf. She has a cochlear implant on one side, which she relies on to hear sounds, including speech, but her first language is sign language.
Okay, well, let's talk about Ivy. By the way, hello, Marnie, if you're listening. And yes, you are well known to the peas, Marnie, and in the hangout as well. And thank you for encouraging your husband, Daniel, I think, on my behalf to join me. And thank you, mate, for being willing. The voices of dads have often been hard to find or hard to hear, not necessarily because they didn't want to talk, although sometimes that's true, but sometimes not being offered a safe place to do it. So that's what we're on about, and I'm so glad you're here. And happy birthday to Ivy, I should say. So let's meet Ivy. Can we meet her first? Describe this little 8-year-old to us. Who is she? What's she like?
Ivy is, after people realize that she's deaf, or sometimes before they realize that she's deaf, what they realize is that she is absolutely full of energy. All sorts of energy, so she'll, you know, physical energy, but also just conversational energy. She describes herself as a chatterbox. And what she loves to chat about is anything and everything under the sun that is going to stretch people's brains. So if you meet her for the first time, I reckon you are just as likely to get a discourse on the family tree of the Olympian gods from ancient Greece as you are to get a blow-by-blow recount of what happened to the dam she was building down at the beach with a bucket and spade. She will just pick a topic and run with it and elaborate on it and question you on it and really just try to engage you at every possible level of enthusiasm about whatever is on her mind. And she's also a very compassionate person is probably the quality that I think comes through once you've been in conversation with her for a little while. She has a very keen sense of justice and injustice and gets quite emotional and concerned about sort of injustice, unfairness, wherever she sees it. And her dream right now, in fact, is to start an animal sanctuary for abused animals or for mistreated animals. And, when I say that that's her dream, I don't just mean that she kind of fantasizes about it like an abstract thing, but she's been looking at other sanctuaries and trying to crunch numbers and figure out how they get money if they're not selling anything and how do they appeal for volunteers. And she's kind of trying to put together, again, this very elaborate idea of how she could go about creating a place like that to alleviate some suffering that she's aware of. So, very imaginative, active, and compassionate person, I think, is the way I'd describe her.
Wow, Daniel, that was brilliant. You've got everyone smiling. What a fantastic introduction to this lovely little girl. And, as parents, we like to take credit for the good traits that we see in our children, don't we?
Yes.
Not so much the others. But I have to say, there is an element of truth in it, isn't there? Something of you and Marnie is clearly being communicated to your lovely daughter. We can tell that you're so articulate and intelligent and compassionate yourselves, and a lot of that is coming through in her. So I just reflect on that as a dad. That was the first thing I thought of. But thank you. I love that introduction, and I guess we've got a little bit of a picture in our mind now of dear Ivy, and we're going to talk about your family life and you as a dad. So why don't we start? When I was speaking to you recently, I asked you, why do you live in Scotland? And when you explained to me how you got to Scotland, I got so much of the story of your family and of Ivy and her coming into the world. So why don't we go from that angle today? So how did you end up in Scotland and why are you there?
The very short version is that I think a lot of people listening to this will be familiar with the journey that you often have to go on when you are trying to find support measures for children who have additional needs, whatever form they may take. And sometimes that journey literally physically takes you from one place to another that you never expected to be, and that's certainly true in our case. That is not to say, though, that we ended up in Scotland as a result of that. I would say that we're in Scotland because there came a time when we were able to make a choice for ourselves rather than kind of dependent on a service or something like that. And that is the choice that sort of led us to where we are. But I'll try and give you a quick sense of the journey. I am half British. I lived in England and Scotland before I met Marnie in Australia for quite a few years. I've spent most of my adult life outside of Australia. But we met in Australia and married, and we were both coming sort of from an education background. Marnie had primary training. I was coming from university education. And there was an opportunity for us both to move to the Swiss Alps in the center of Switzerland to teach at a boarding school and to sort of take on a pastoral role with young people at a boarding school there, English and German bilingual. Marnie speaks German, among her many other talents. So we moved to Switzerland, and we were there for 2 years before Ivy was born. And it really was the middle of nowhere. It was a 2.5 hour train journey, a 2 hour drive to the nearest city in the hills. So when we found out that our daughter was profoundly deaf, which was not at birth, there was just the accessibility for us of not just services but a deaf community, sign language lessons for ourselves, a signing community for Ivy. None of this was there, and it wasn't even close to where we were. In fact, some of it wasn't even in Switzerland. You had to go to Germany for it. So that upended us completely. And for various reasons at this point in time, we were trying to consider, well, where do we go? There were great difficulties with returning to Australia. There were difficulties with going to any number of other places. So we ended up in London, largely because there was a supportive school with a nursery attached. So Ivy at this point was 14 months old. The nursery would take her in occasionally from 18 months, and it was a fully signing environment. So we were in London for a year. That didn't work out for financial reasons, among other things. So then we went to a different city in England, Birmingham, which is the only city that has another signing nursery in England. So that's your choice, London or Birmingham, if you need a signing environment for very young children. And we were there for a few years, which led Ivy into the early years of school, but we were never very happy there. It was never really our place. It was very difficult to deal with the local authorities. Any number of things were difficult and draining. And so when COVID hit, Ivy was already on the way out of school before the lockdown came and actually closed schools. So we did a sort of root and branch reassessment of our lives and decided, it looks like we're in a situation for the foreseeable future where Ivy will be home educated and where we can provide the things she needs, most of the things. Is there a place we can go that has a community for her that that we can connect with and get the other things that we can't provide? And the answer was yes, and it was back in Scotland, to a place we'd been before, about 20 miles south of Edinburgh, which is where we're now settled and feeling very well rewarded for making that decision.
Wow. Wow.
A lot of moving, I guess, is the really short version.
You know, we use the word journey a lot, don't we, these days? But that really is journeying, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So let's back up a fraction then. So you were both teaching in Switzerland at a boarding school. What were you teaching?
Well, I was teaching, there's a program, a university level program for students in their last 2 years of secondary school where they can get college credit, university credit by taking advanced courses. So I taught English and history there, and Marnie taught languages. So she gave some basic German to English speakers and also taught English to German speakers. And we were both in the school administration as well.
Leadership. So may I suggest that for home education, Ivy is very well placed.
That was one of the things that we were recognized very early on. The actual provision of education is, there's very little we could offer materially ourselves, but that was one thing we could handle.
Yeah, terrific. And so Ivy was born while you were in Switzerland.
Yes.
And that was all straightforward, was it? How was the birth process?
It was a little bumpy. There weren't any complications at birth that led to anything that came later on, but there's a weird kind of retrospective thing. So Ivy was born about 10 days ahead of schedule, so pretty much on time. It was a long labour, but she came out okay. But then she developed some jaundice for the first 2 weeks or so, which is quite easily treated by if anyone knows anyone who's had jaundice as a kid, the baby basically goes into an ultraviolet box, a box bombarded with ultraviolet light to stimulate, I don't know, the production of the bilirubin. But because it's ultraviolet light, they have to wear like an eye mask. It's dangerous for the eyes. And so we didn't know Ivy was deaf at that time. So for those 2 weeks, you know, I remember sitting beside the box where you know, they have to just stay in there and it's hard to reach in and touch them and, you know, just not wanting to let her know that she was alone. So I would read aloud to her, you know, for hours at a time. And that was, at the time, I think, a very comforting thing for us. But in retrospect, you know, when we found out that she couldn't hear any of it, you just have this plummeting feeling in your gut where it's like, oh, it was total sensory deprivation for her.
Oh, man.
And that kind of explained why she was often really, really distressed in there. So, yeah, that was really the only complication, though. And then what happened was, of course, there's a newborn hearing screening check, which Ivy didn't pass once or twice when we were there and watched the nurse administer it. And the nurse said, no, they often don't pass it the first couple of times because there's, you know, there's stuff in their ears that needs to come out. And, you know, we just do it each day. And then we kind of thought, yeah, but okay, but what if, you know, what if she actually can't hear anything? What would that be like? But then at some point overnight, someone did a check, which we didn't see, and they signed off, yes, fine, positive, she can hear. So we got a false positive, and, you know, didn't think much of it. Occasionally, you know, it would come up when weird things happened over the next few months, but it wasn't until she was 6 months old where she wasn't really turning towards voices when she could hear them, when someone was in the room, that Marnie said, this is not right, and we took her to the pediatrician, and the pediatrian said straight away, yeah, she's deaf. That was a false positive.
Okay. Goodness. I'm just picturing you reading to her, you know, and
yeah,
that act of love means something, of course, but then to sense or to discover afterwards that she wasn't able to hear what you were saying. My goodness.
Yeah.
Listen, am I jumping ahead too far if I ask you, like you have told me, that there are now complicating factors in addition to the deafness?
Yeah, well, yes, kind of together with the deafness. So I've used the term profoundly deaf quite a bit, actually. I should probably say that profound deafness is the most intense, most severe type of deafness. I don't like using the word severe because there's also a category called severe deafness. But profound deafness basically means that, well, as our audiologist put it to us straight off the bat, Ivy had to wear headphones when she was 6 months old in a clinical setting, and those headphones pumped out noise that was the equivalent of a person standing next to a helicopter with both rotors going, and she had no reaction at all. So that's the level that you're at with profound deafness. You really can't hear virtually anything. So Ivy's deafness is the result of a malformation of the inner ear that's really quite rare. The estimates is that it affects about 0.00002% of the population, I think. We're talking a couple of hundred people in the UK, maximum of all ages. And so this inner ear malformation, A, means that she can't hear, but because the inner ear is also what regulates balance, like it gives you kind of a spirit level in your head, so you know when you're tilting side to side.
Yeah.
It means that she can't really regulate her balance. She has great difficulty doing that using those parts of the body. She relies on her eyes and her proprioception through hands and feet. And then also for this reason, she kind of has a craving for sensory stimulation, particularly through the hands and feet, all the time. You know, she'll always want to be touching things and moving herself around to get interesting feelings in her balance experience. And then recently, in addition to that, she's been diagnosed with ADHD, which is very powerful addition to the above, because the lack of impulse control in her means that, you know, when she's seeking sensory stimulation, she'll often just run and do it without being aware of or considering dangers or other people or things like that. And in addition to all of that, she has been identified as a highly able person. So she's well above her age peers in learning, in cognitive activity, and significantly above what we call her hearing age peers, which means, you know, she's 8 years old, but her hearing is only 6 years old. So in a school setting, she would be grouped with people, with children of that age, that hearing age. And so she's well above that, which puts her in a category called twice exceptional, or DME, dual and multiple exceptionalities, which means that in an educational setting, she requires something above, support for learning above the her age, and but she also requires support for special needs that typically lead children to lag behind their age. So she's pulling in both directions, and the institutional support for that essentially doesn't exist.
I think there's a technical term for the balance issue, the depth perception and so on. What's that called?
It's called vestibular hypofunction. And, yeah, it's the depth perception is another thing. So essentially every person who does not have an inner ear malformation relies on three things to keep their balance: their eyes, their inner ear structure, and their proprioception, which is through feet and hands. And without one, she relies on the other two. But it also means that, yeah, that sometimes, like, if you're trying to stand on the edge of a swimming pool and look to the bottom of the pool, you're relying on all three. Your eyes are connecting with your inner ear structure to tell you that that is quite deep. And she can only sort of see it as a flat plane, if you like, almost not in three dimensions. She can't judge the depth. So she knows intellectually that she should not jump into water, just like that. But the experience of understanding how deep something is not available to her.
You mentioned sensory seeking. Is that what you called it? How does that show up?
All sorts of ways. If she goes into a shop, for example, and there's anything that seems like it's made of an interesting feeling fabric or will have an interesting texture, she'll run straight over to it and will brush it or just try to feel what it feels like. But it also means things like, at my parents' place here, when you go outside, you have a footpath, which is nice and flat and goes alongside the road. And then next to it, you have sort of ornamental rocks and things, which are very unsteady and have sharp angles and whatnot. And you would anticipate that someone who has difficulty balancing would stick to the footpath, particularly when there are cars nearby, but her feet crave the unpredictable sensory input of those rocks. Stimulation. Yeah, so she'll just jump onto them and try to balance, or yeah, anything. Anything that doesn't feel bland, really, is where she goes.
So is she always reaching out to touch as well?
Yep, always, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, even to her peril, you know, lots of sharp leaves around here too, and she just cannot sometimes stop, you know, from just seizing a palm leaf or something and running her hand along it and getting herself a cut. But just the feeling of it is what she...
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What?
She's aware of not touching something hot, for example, though.
Yeah, she's intellectually aware, yeah. But her impulse control really is very, very low. So even knowing it, we literally have conversations about, you know, don't get too close to that, it's really hot. And she'll say, I know. And she'll still be standing there reaching out, you know. So the intellectual knowledge and the kind of experience in the moment are not always connected.
Balance. So how does she cope with, say, motion sickness or, you know, that sort of thing?
Yeah, motion sickness is the funny one that she doesn't get because if you're to get motion sickness, you need to have the feeling of imbalance in your head with your inner ear structure. And then it comes from like your eyes trying to lock onto a fixed point as you're moving. And she, without the first thing, her eyes just don't try to lock onto anything. So she doesn't get dizzy. She doesn't get motion sickness. And when we were testing this to see if, you know, to diagnose her with this vestibular condition, I took her down to London once to the ear, nose and throat hospital. And we had to do a test where she sat on my lap. I sat in a chair, a special chair that was mechanized, and she sat on my lap, and they attached to her face a gigantic pair of goggles that had cameras on the inside. So the cameras were pointing at her eyes so that they could see on a screen what her eyes were doing as she moved. And what happened was the chair just spun around, like pivoted around. And I immediately wanted to throw up. I don't like rides at all. I was instantly sick. And she just loved it. It was like getting swung around. And she thought it was like a ride at a fun fair or something. And what the video showed was that her eyes moved once to try to lock onto something. Like, you know, when you sat on a bus and you look out the window and everything's whipping past, you try to fix on one thing. Her eyes did that once, and then that was it. Then there was no attempt to sort of stabilize. They didn't do it because they weren't getting the extra input from the inner ear structure. So she can't get dizzy, as she will proudly tell you if you ever discuss it with her.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Now, I'm just picturing, so she's sitting on your lap and you're in this contraption, this chair. So she's with Dad. Yeah. So you're a hands-on dad, are you? You're very involved in everything in her life by the sound of it.
Yeah, pretty much. I look after her basically on a day-to-day basis. Yeah, so Marnie does a lot of the strategic long-term stuff, like when do we need to book the next appointment and what does this report mean for, you know, disability allowance or whatever. And I'm her shepherd from appointment to appointment and her educator and just companion, really, yeah, day-to-day.
One of the dynamics, of course, as parents is how we approach these kinds of situations in our lives. And when you got married, obviously, you don't know what's coming. You feel as though you would want to build a life together. You connect, you know, you communicate and so on. And then you are together in this kind of very complex kind of and let's say demanding situation. How have things been with you and Marnie? How do you share the load? How do you get on? Do you have? Are you able to support each other? Do you feel?
Yeah, I do now. I think we do now. I think in the first instance, Marnie was the one. You know, I mean, in the first like year, 2 years, it was Marnie who was with Ivy all the time and going to those early years interventions and, you know, all that sort of thing, all the appointments. And then we kind of split it for a couple of years after that, 3 or 4 years after that. And then around the time Ivy was 5 was when I really took over quite a bit more. And I think it was really hard in those early years. I think particularly in those 2 or 3 years in between where we were trying to do it 50-50. I didn't really know what to do to support Marnie. I think she tried to support me as much as she could, but she didn't know either, and I didn't know what kind of support I needed. And it was kind of a really long period of grasping around in the dark and not being sure of what either of us really wanted or were doing or whether we were doing it right. And just a lot of anxiety and uncertainty. And I think part of it came from like a real imbalance, I think, between the three of us as a family. Like, I think we were rightly very concerned with Ivy as an individual, particularly in the early years, and kind of, you know, oriented our entire lives around meeting that need, much to the detriment of our own needs. And so we kind of have been progressively like trying to rebalance it so that, you know, it's a compromise situation. Nobody gets everything that they want, but if everybody's getting a little bit of just what they need to keep going and support themselves and support each other, then it's more manageable and it feels a bit less crisis mode, which is a strange thing to say because it has been the last 2 years that we've gotten into that. It has been the COVID years. And I think that's an odd thing for someone to say that's been their experience of the COVID years, is that you're getting out of crisis mode.
And but how did that happen? Why would the COVID years do that?
I guess it all comes back to where we were before, and Ivy's dual and multiple exceptionality. So where we got to was a stage, I guess, around 2017, 2018, where Ivy was in a school for deaf children, meaning that sign language was the primary language of instruction with English support. And we were told, and there's only a very few number of these schools across Britain. We were told that the school couldn't meet her needs anymore, and the needs that it couldn't meet were her intellectual needs. So the school sort of sent us off on a mission to find an alternative school for Ivy. So over, I guess, the period of about 18 months, we invested just a ridiculous number of hours and a ridiculous amount of money into traveling the country, to the south of England, up to Scotland, out west. We went just about everywhere that there was a primary school for deaf children to try to find somewhere that could take her. And we're preparing to upend our lives all over again to try and get this next place to work, wherever it was. And what it came down to was that there was a place in the Midlands, it's near Birmingham, the area around it, that wasn't a deaf school. It was a mainstream school that was willing to kind of make the necessary accommodations for Ivy according to what had been identified as her needs by doctors and professionals. And so with this head teacher of this school and the head teacher of the school she was at, we went to the local authority and we put all the reports and we got all these agreements in a meeting. It's a meeting that went on for days and days. We finally got this agreement that Ivy would go to this school in September 2019. And then the local authority just stopped playing ball. They took out parts of the accommodations that they'd agreed to in the written plan, I mean. So then the school that Ivy was supposed to go to said, well, we can't do it if that doesn't work. And everybody was dragging their heels. And this is around September, October 2019. And it got to the point where Ivy was coming out of school more often for a day or coming out early. And I was giving her the things that she wasn't getting at school educationally. So it felt like we had the worst of both worlds, where essentially we had to give her her education, but also we had to get into these long arguments about where she should go to school. And then, you know, it kind of all just fell apart around that time for us, the whole structure. And we knew that the school that she was at wouldn't take her for another year. She would be kind of excluded by attrition or by refusal. And then in March, that was COVID and everybody was out of school. And I kind of looked at it and thought, if I can get this right in this incredibly stressful and unprecedented time. If I can take Ivy's education and give her what she needs as you know, the advanced material that she needs in a home setting, then we don't have to be here because the other infrastructure that we had here is already gone. And that meant that if we didn't have to be there, we could be anywhere that would be, in theory, finances providing certain opportunities. We could go somewhere else where Marnie and I could rebalance things in a way that suited our lifestyles and our needs and our wants and hopes for the future. So that was kind of why the crisis was an opportunity, a big reset button for us. You know, just when everything collapsed with the lockdown, then we didn't have the services that we'd depended on and fought for up to that point. They just stopped in Britain. I don't really know how it was in Australia, but in Britain it all just stopped.
Yeah.
For 3 months we were without. It was just us. And once we saw that we could do some of the basic things, certainly not the medical things, but some of the basic things that we thought we couldn't do, then we could sort of look around and say, well, where can we get the medical things to kind of supplement the bits that we can do if we take on home education full time? And that's what we did. That's where we ended up.
Okay. You know, that makes sense. I understand now. Going back for a second to you and Marnie, you know, there's no getting around the fact that a lot of the parents that we're in touch with, a lot of the P's are doing it on their own because their partnership didn't survive or hasn't lasted, and they're single parents, usually single mums, and it's a reality that just adds that extra dimension. So I'm glad to hear you say that things are okay now and that you're working through those things. Well done to both of you for making that happen. And, you know, I don't pretend that there won't be any further bumps along the way, but good on you for getting to that point. And, you know, looking after each other is such a big part of looking after Ivy, is it not?
It is. Yeah, absolutely. And she, as I say, she's a very compassionate person, which means I guess she's very aware of people's emotional states, particularly when they're not talking about them. So she would be right onto it if things weren't working for us.
It strikes me that your parents and Marnie's parents are in Australia. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
So you've had this whole experience, this whole journey without the support of grandparents and an extended family. How's that been?
I wouldn't want to say without, because there are ways that they have supported us that have been very important, but let's say not in their presence for the most part. That's certainly true. I don't know, Gary, what can I say? Just taking the broadest view, I guess I should say first that my experience is that people, not just family, but everybody in proximity to us as parents of a child with special needs are unpredictable and a mixed bag. And that means that I have been very surprised, pleasantly surprised, by people who had no prior connection to us, by people who had only a very peripheral connection to us at the beginning, who really understood what was happening and stepped up when they really had no call to do any of that. It was not their responsibility. And so, you know, on the one hand, you really do get that sort of thing from people who you just, you know, you grow close to because they were strangers before. And then by showing understanding, they became friends and or closer friends. And that's, I guess, the soft way of saying that family too has been a mixed bag. We went in not with any expectations because we didn't know what we were getting into when Ivy was diagnosed, but with hopes or assumptions that that if you say something as basic as the initial diagnosis was that Ivy would never hear, and that even if she got a cochlear implant, it may not work for her. And that was the diagnosis that held for the first 3 years of her life. So if you go in and you say to people who are very close to you that this is the situation and here's a child who, you know, is literally like a one-year-old kid who may never hear and will rely on signing for communication, I guess I had the assumption that that meant that the adults in the room would recognize that adults have to take on the responsibility of learning something new and dealing with it that way. And, I mean, some did and some didn't and some tried, but they kind of fell away. And, you know, friends who were there at the start were not there a few months later and, you know, all those sorts of things. And family, it's, you know, it's still difficult with family. My parents, yeah, have been very supportive. Marnie's parents are supportive and interested. The degrees of that vary quite dramatically. Equally, you know, there's an immediate family member who I'm essentially estranged from for reasons intimately connected to Ivy's needs and everything we've been through, and I guess what I would describe as just an inability to accept the way things are. So how was it to not be close to these people? It was really it was very difficult for both of us because we were just without relief in a very fundamental sense. But I also don't want to downplay the reality that we were unexpectedly compensated by the generosity of the people who were around us, even though they weren't family.
What's the name of the place you're living in that's just outside of Edinburgh?
It's called Innerleithen.
And so how long have you been settled there now?
We've been there nearly 2 years. We had been there before to visit a bit before COVID, and then it was about a month, 6 weeks into the first lockdown where we said that's the place we need to go.
Small town, is it?
Yeah, there's about 3,500 people there. But one of the reasons that took us there is that throughout the Scottish borders, which is the area it's in, there's a very strong home education community. About, I would say, from the people Ivy interacts with, there's maybe a quarter to a third of the kids there have additional needs. Some of them are flexi-schooled, so the school does their education and they have a lot of time out. So that was important for us, that we were going to a place where that kind of thing existed and we could connect with people. And then there's also a very strong deaf community in Edinburgh itself, and Edinburgh is it's about 45 minutes away for us, so quite accessible. And Ivy has lately met, you know, for the first time in her life, three other girls between 6 and 9, so her age range, with cochlear implants, you know. So that was not something we expected, you know. It's just something that has turned up and that we'd hoped was there because the community is there, but we finally kind of found that for her, some age peers who are just like her.
So would you say all of you have made some profound connections there? You've got some real community there.
I would definitely say that. I would definitely say that. Of the places we've been over the last 8 years, the strongest community is there right now.
And how about other dads? Are you in touch with other dads?
Rarely.
Really?
Even then, you know, with a large home education community. It's very, I am the only man I see most of the time in those settings, which
how
is tough.
How are you with that?
It's, you know, I'm okay with it. I think I'm the kind of person who will sort of accept things as they are when you front up to something. But there are times when it is really strange and a little bit disorienting and alienating. I'm thinking particularly of, you know, just even this is like 3 weeks ago, you know, where I was in a regular meetup with, it's all women, and there was just a conversation about how hopeless the men are, how hopeless men are in when it comes to parenting. And I, not just as a one-off comment, but like, oh, why? What are the reasons for this? You know, is it because of X, you know, this sort of relationship at birth? It was a long conversation, and I just didn't say anything. And I thought, wow, it's like, on the one hand, that's very, very alienating. On the other hand, I recognize that it's probably a compliment that they don't think of me as a man like
as
that.
A
I
dad.
Think they just weren't thinking of me that way. No, yeah, as a dad, it was. As one of the mums, really, yeah. But so I mean, it's kind of a mixed thing. But I guess strange enough to be noticeable often for me.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I've had a very similar experience, and often the question is, you know, what's strange here? What's wrong with me? What's right with me? What's going on here? How come there's no other dads around? And is that good or bad? And so on. But it is the reality for many of us. And let's talk about dadness then for a second, or maleness. You know, I mean, none of us goes into parenthood knowing exactly what to expect. We see what's possible, but, you know, we don't know what's coming. When you became a dad, how did you get on with your dad?
I guess I get on with my dad okay. Honestly, actually, I never really thought about that. I don't think I've really given a lot of thought to the depth of our relationship. But I mean, my dad was always, we're from a working class family where my dad was holding down multiple jobs. And so my dad was always very busy, but he was never not supportive of things that I wanted to do, even when they diverged quite radically from his interests. So I can't say that he was a bad or neglectful dad at all.
Okay. And the things that this has drawn out of you as a person, like becoming a dad and becoming specifically Ivy's dad, would you say what's that brought out in you?
Is it weird to say that I often feel as alienated amongst dads as I do amongst the mothers that I tend to work with? I mean, it's funny, until you've just said that, I've never considered really measuring myself or looking at myself in relation to my own dad. The way I tend to do it is to look at myself in relation to the dads that I do see and know, who may not be in our immediate circle, but friends, you know, from before and abroad. And when I see them in action, you know, my peers really, I feel very much on the outside of whatever it is that they're doing, which is what I think of as being a dad. I think they have, you know, most dads that I know that don't have special needs kids, they have there's an easiness and kind of a simplicity to the interactions between them and their kids that is just not me. And I just feel like that's kind of inaccessible to me. That you know, because in any interaction with my daughter, I'm managing things, communication, danger awareness, and then, you know, her, and then comes like the meaningful interactions, the things that she wants to talk about and think over, and they're very complex, and I don't see that in my peers. So I feel like I feel like whatever I've got is something a little bit different from mainstream fatherhood. It's more like, Well, one thing that people remark on when they see me and Ivy in interaction is that we're more like peers than anything, that I talk to her like an adult and she talks to me like an adult. And I think that's right. I think that when I'm just with Ivy, when I'm being her father, I'm not a dad like the other dads are a dad. It's more like I'm a person and she recognizes me as a person. And being a father is just one aspect of the whole person. And she kind of acknowledges that. So it's a different quality of interaction to what I see elsewhere. And I don't know if that's a positive or a negative. You know, I say I feel a bit alienated, but I also feel a bit sorry for my peers who when they're interacting with their kids, that they are seen as dad and not as a person with dad as a component. I think that could be a loss for them. I guess that's a very complex answer. I don't know if it makes much sense, but I can't really articulate what it feels like to be on the outside of that thing that I think of as dadness. I don't think I've got it. I think I've just got something else.
Daniel, I have so appreciated this conversation. You have this most wonderful daughter, and you know, by the sound of the way you speak about her, it's quite clear that she has the most wonderful dad also. And I just wanted to say to you, you're a bloody good dad, and you know, thank you for sharing all of this. Before we wrap things up, was there something you wanted to touch on that we missed that you felt was really important to say?
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on just an experience that I haven't mentioned yet, but also it kind of connects to what I was saying about family and expectations. And I think the probably one of the most difficult things that we've been through in the last 8 years was on Ivy's third birthday. And this is, so in other words, this is after we'd already moved twice and we're starting to get things in place. And we'd had these conversations in the January that things were starting to look up and, you know, maybe we were getting back on our feet a little bit. And then Ivy's birthday, of course, is in April, usually around Easter. And then on that day, Ivy contracted meningitis. Meningitis is a risk for any kids. It's higher for kids who have cochlear implants because the implant requires opening up the blockage between the outside world and the brain so the bacteria can get in more easily. And it's even more of a risk for kids like Ivy who don't have an inner ear structure because there is nothing to block it. So it was bound to happen, and it looks like it could be a recurrent problem throughout her life. Anyway, anyone who has been through anything like that will know the sheer terror of it. That, you know, when I went rushed Ivy to hospital, I was with her. I rushed her to hospital in an ambulance. She was well and truly out of it. We didn't know if she would wake up. We didn't know if she would die. We didn't know if she would recover with none of the function that she had before. There were just days there where she was out of it, and we did not know what was going to happen, you know, whenever she came around, if she did. And it really threw up into the air just everything that we'd already done up to that point. I remember having, in addition to the terror, just this incredible anger and rage that we had already sacrificed. Everything, our entire life before, was gone. My career was gone. Marnie's job was in the gutter. Our friends were not there. We were far away from everything. Parents had tried to rise to the task. Some hadn't risen. And it was just like there was so much. And then it just felt like this massive smackdown just at the moment when we were thinking, okay, maybe we can get out of it. And, you know, like a massive punch in the face. And I reckon that anger stayed with me for a long time afterwards, even when Ivy did recover. And it is, and it, yeah, and it is something that I can feel kind of, it gets antagonized a bit when I encounter people who just don't know or don't care about what we've had to do to just deal with the basics of life over the last few years, you know. And so I guess the takeaway is that if you're a father who goes through that, or a parent who goes through something extreme like that, and you do have that incredible anger, that it's easy to hold it against people who remind you of it, who bring it back in some way. And it took me a while to get to the point where I realized just how exhausting that is and how it just warps you as a person. And I think it takes real effort and practice to let go of those forms of anger, particularly when they do come at moments of intense trauma, in a word. But it's so worth it, you know, and I think I've only been able to come back to the last few years because of making a concerted effort to just say the anger that's there is not worth it. You've just got to let it go. And sometimes that means letting people go, and that can be worth it too, which is a bit of a taboo thing to say, I think. But anything you can do to not live with that feeling is to the good, I think. And I think probably some men could do with hearing something like that. I know I could have much earlier than now.
Daniel, it's been great talking to you, man. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.